apologize for this graphic. I tried to throw it together in the middle of the night last night. It's meant to be a two-coupled pendula, this one representing the axion, the swinging of the QCD theta angle, and coupled to some kind of resonant detector, in which case, in this particular case, it's a nonlinear oscillator given by realized as a Josephson junction that's used in superconducting circuits, a particular kind of qubit. Okay, so just as a little bit of background, I am a member of the ADMX Generation 2 experiment that has recently reached sensitivity to QCD axion level signals. And if anybody wants to talk to me about that afterwards, I'm happy to talk. That's not what this seminar is going to be about. So just a quick review of QCD axions. They were originally, this is part of a model originally proposed by Pache and Quinn about 30 years ago, in which there's this problem in which you have these CP violating phases in QCD that would give you a non-zero electric dipole moment for the neutron, which was not actually observed despite more than 50 years of experiments. And the idea is that they introduce a new scalar field, which couples to this combination of gluon field strength tensors in the same way. And then they postulate some kind of phase transition in the early universe, which separates the scalar field into a radial degree of freedom, very heavy degree of freedom, and a massless Nambu-Goldstone boson. And then during the QCD phase transition, they noted that this Mexican hat potential gets tilted. And so the scalar field rolls to a new unique minimum of its potential, at which it takes some value that cancels out any pre-existing CP violating angle. And thus, the total CP violating angle is zeroed out, neutron EDM vanishes, and you solve the strong CP problem. All right, so again, the original phase transition temperature scale is rather high, so greater than 10 to the 9 GeV or so. And the amount of tilt that you get is a quantity called the topological susceptibility. And because this tilt comes from this kind of condensate, instanton condensate, it has something to do with the QCD scale, so you can estimate the potential energy density contained in this tilt as lambda QCD to the fourth power. Okay, so this is, if you want to go into detailed models, there might be some modifications to that, but this is the general cartoon picture of what's going on. Okay, so then you have a new unique minimum of the potential. So if you zoom in on that minimum, you'll have some kind of quadratic potential, and so you can quantize about that minimum. The harmonic oscillator frequency is the mass of this new excitation, and it's just given by the ratio of how much you tilted it by this lever arm. So it's uniquely determined by these two temperature scales. And right now, we think the masses are at milli-EV or less. But because this seesaw mechanism was kind of introduced in a very appealing geometric, this a very appealing geometric picture, you kind of see that the mass, because you tied this to the QCD scale to solve the neutron, the strong CP problem, then if you pick a phase transition scale, this Pache-Quinn scale, it almost uniquely determines the mass, and vice versa. So this is a very nice compared to like supersymmetry, where there's like a million different parameters. Here, there's only like a single parameter that experimentalists at least need to worry about. We pick the mass and use this formula to uniquely determine the coupling up to a factor of order unity. So it gives a well-defined target.
Couplings to photons or to electrons, especially.
Okay, but I think, generally, when people say there's an order one coupling, that's might be some theoretical prejudice.
In the electrons, it could be more than order one.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, so then the other thing is that you could view this as kind of some kind of cosmological feedback loop, in which you have a quantity that you want to zero out, and experimentalists know how to zero things out. They create a potential to zeros it out. In this case, it turns out there was a natural cosmological potential that would force the field down to the CP conserving minimum. But in the cosmological setting, this energy density is real. Okay, you can't get rid of it. It doesn't get burnt up in some resistor somewhere in your electronics. When you're accounting for all of the energy in the universe, which is locally conserved, this has to go somewhere. And where it goes is dark matter. Okay, so this initial potential energy density, when the axion field, which is presumably single-valued everywhere within the cosmological horizon at that time, when that vacuum relaxes to its minimum value, this potential energy density gets stored as oscillations about the minimum. And these are this is in the internal space, so it gets stored as axion mass as in the form of dark matter axions. So the amount of potential energy density that you have at the beginning to convert into dark matter energy density ranges anywhere from zero if by chance this ball representing the state of the vacuum happened to be at the minimum already when you started. Okay, then there is no potential energy density to convert into dark matter. If you happen to start near the top of this potential, then you get this full amount of lambda QCD to the fourth of potential energy density. So the random initial angle, so back before this was tilted, all initial states were equally probable at different parts of the universe. This theta angle, the initial theta angle probably took all possible values between 0 and pi. But this random initial theta angle locally determines the available potential energy density that you can convert into dark matter. Okay. So here's just a quick roadmap. I'm not going to go through all of this of the single parameter QCD axion model. So it's masses down here. And as I said, there's a one-to-one correspondence through the seesaw mechanism between the mass of the excitation and the coupling suppression scale. So the blue is the astrophysical constraints, pink are the hints, like we see that dark matter exists, and there's some region in which you would predict that that this model would be very good at producing the dark matter. The gray, like this, those are actual experimental results, and then the green are the planned experiments. So I mentioned the ADMX-G2 experiment. We're currently at about 600 megahertz. We're going up to 10 gigahertz. That's the plan, so that's 40 micro EV. CASPER experiment looking for AC neutron electric dipole moments, and the CAST experiment looking at for KEV axion emissions from the sun. But the one thing, a couple of things I want to point out is that the most stringent constraint right now for higher masses appears to be the duration of the neutrino pulse emitted by supernova 1987A. It was about the right duration as would be expected if the neutrino emission were the primary supernova cooling mechanism, so there's no need for any other light scalar fields coupling to nucleons. And so that places a constraint on the coupling scale, which then translates into a constraint on the mass of about 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. And from below, there's a long story of dark matter production, which would be excluded under certain scenarios. I'll quickly go through this. So this was in the news lately. There's a Nature paper from a lattice simulation from Borsagni et al., in which they attempted to compute the actual tilt of that potential, the topological susceptibility. So how much does the potential energy change if you change the theta angle away from its minimum at zero. But the result that they got, evolving the universe down to its present temperature, is pretty much what you expect, about lambda QCD to the fourth power. Okay. So far, this picture still seems to be holding together. And again, this scale kind of gives you the scale of the potential energy that's available to convert into dark matter. So imagine that you have locally, you have buckets of dark matter. Each bucket is a cosmological horizon big. But you have buckets of dark matter that at some time you're going to, buckets of potential energy that you're going to dump into the universe as dark matter. Okay, so here's a nice illustration that was a little bit more successful at cutting and pasting. So imagine you have this bucket of dark matter. Here's the dark matter that's shaped like fish. And you're going to dump it into your pond at some time. And you're going to dump it at a time, cosmological time, 1 over h is about 1 over the dark matter mass. Because the dark matter mass, if you look at the Klein-Gordon equation, that's the only dimensionful constant that's in that equation. So that's the time scale in which the vacuum can evolve from its non-minimum state to its minimum state. Okay, so this is the cosmological time at which you're going to dump that bucket of fish in. And this is happening during, presumably, the radiation-dominated era. So if you're waiting too long, the river is drying up. You didn't get enough rain. And if you waited too long, there's not very much water in the river. You dump the fish in, and there's too much fish for the water. Okay. So if you have a bucket filled to the level of sine squared theta naught, the initial value of times the topological susceptibility, so that's the initial potential energy density. If you have if your bucket is that full, if you dump it too late, then you've got to have this improper balance of fish to water. So the only way to solve that problem is then you better not have too many fish in that bucket when you dump it. So if you have very, very small axion mass, that means you're dumping it very late, then you require that the initial potential energy density has to be very small, so you happen to be very close to the minimum of that potential. Okay? So then there's two scenarios. So the fullness of bucket kind of depends on when this initial Peche-Quinn phase transition happened relative to when cosmic inflation happened. Because when you have a phase transition, unless you do it very, very smoothly and grow a very nice, perfect uniform crystal, that could happen, I don't know. But normally, if you just do your phase transition, you're going to have a bunch of different topological domains, right? Just like in a ferromagnet. And so imagine if this happened, and then afterwards you turned on an external magnetic field, then each one of these spin domains would have a different energy. Okay, that's an exact analogy to what's happening in the case of the QCD axions. So in the QCD axions, this is a figure taken from the early universe from Mike and Rocky. You have different regions of the universe, different topological bubbles with different initial values of this random theta angle. And then once the gluons condense as instantons, then each of these will have a different potential energy density. So if this happens before inflation, then each of these bubbles gets inflated, and our current cosmological horizon is just inside one of these bubbles, say this one, 0.38. And it's just possible by pure chance that we just are living in a bubble with a very, very small theta angle. That bucket is almost empty to begin with, so it doesn't matter how late you dump it. Okay. On the other hand, if the axion transition happens post-inflation, then you imagine that our cosmological horizon then contains many, many of these bubbles. And you just have to take the ensemble average of these, where sine squared theta on average is equal to 1/2. So on average, the buckets are half full. You have a lot of potential energy to dump. And so you better not dump it too late in that case. So that brings up this figure, also from that Nature paper, of axion mass versus the initial theta angle. Okay, so again, if you're dumping it too late, then that theta angle better be pretty small so that the bucket is almost empty to begin with, right? And so this curve is if the dark matter saturates omega matter. And if you're going to dump it early, then it's OK for the bucket to be almost full. And in fact, it's even OK for there to be many, many buckets within our horizon.
This is from which paper again? This is from the Ringwald.
Yeah, exactly.
See, there's still uncertainty over this. Because it's not clear that there are two conflicting results, one from simulation from people in Italy and these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear who is correct.
Yep. That's right.
So that shifts the line up there, right?
Yeah, yeah, this division between the pre-inflation axion phase transition and the post-inflation axion phase transition.
Yeah.
So exactly where this the dividing line is still subject of debate. And the second thing is you also have the other production mechanism of decay of topological defects, which then stabilize that potential energy density and delay its release even further. In that case, you might want to push this dividing line towards even higher mass. This particular paper, the Borsani et al. Paper, assume that you have that half of the dark matter is produced from the topological defect decays, and half comes from the vacuum energy,
that's
where the vacuum is not constrained to relax.
Yeah, but that's not
so
clear. It's a good assumption, right?
Right.
Because there
right.
is also conflicting statements in the literature about that. So it could be that's
then
larger than 1.5.
Right, right. So
we don't know yet.
Yeah, that's right. So Pierre Sakivi thinks that a 50-50 from each source is about right, whereas other people think that you're dominated by the string decays.
Yes, exactly.
Right,
so
right.
It's not clear. Which
so if you're dominated by string decays, you really want to be all the way up at milli EV milli EV right around here. So you want to move this guy all the way up to here, and have
yeah,
to.
Basically yeah. Basically, this will shift the line.
Yep. Exactly. So. So as an experimentalist, I just take the point of view that we'll find what we find, and then the phenomenologists will revise their assumptions. So the point is that there is somewhere around here, there is a division between pre-inflationary versus post-inflationary, and that tells us that by looking for axion dark matter, we can learn something about the scale energy scale of inflation. So energy scale of inflation is the prediction for R, the ratio of tensor to scalar power in the CMB, goes something like this. So the current experiments are probing the 10 to the 16 GeV scale for inflatons, for inflation. It works out that, again, plotting mass versus initial theta angle, if you just kind of zoom in at this transition point, the dividing point was here, where the axion mass scale, the axion phase transition scale, was characterized by 10 to the 10, 10 to the 12 GeV, whereas the CMB people are looking at 10 to the 16 GeV. So if the CMB people, those experiments see B modes, then they can infer that the energy scale of inflation is 10 to the 16 GeV, whereas if the axions are happening post-inflation at this lower temperature, then the axions would have to be up here. Okay, so that's why I drew this yellow box over here. So if you see the B modes, then you predict higher axion mass than where experiments like ADMX are currently looking. Okay, so. When Bicep came out with the results, which were later retracted, all of us working on axion searches at lower masses immediately threw in the towel and just gave up. And that was very sad, because then they later retracted the results and we shouldn't have given up so early. So the converse of that is, they've retracted, but there's still this possibility that they could come out any day now with results that would
not
just kill our entire program.
Doubting this result.
Yeah. Right. So the converse of this is, if ADMX or any of the other experiments that are probing lower mass axions finds a signal, then we're looking at pre-inflationary axions, axion phase transitions that happen at scales of 10 to the 12 GeV or so. And in that case, that implies, because this is pre-inflation, implies that the scale of inflation is below 10 to the 12 GeV, then that implies that the CMB people cannot see B modes, because there's not enough energy density to, in the gravitational waves to create a signal. Okay, so the point here is that the CMB experiments and the current axion searches are complementary probes of the scale of inflation. Okay, so we do not want to be stuck in that Bicep-like scenario again, where any moment now all of our experiments could be killed. So the question is, how do we cover this region that would be favored by a positive B-mode signal? How do we move to these higher frequencies? What is it that prevents us from doing that immediately instead of being stuck down here? I mean, it would be very nice if we if by two different approaches we both narrowed in on the scale of inflation at 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay. So to understand why we don't do it, I'm going to cover a little bit of dark matter detection. So this is these are slides that I show incoming graduate students when I try to recruit them, comparing axions to WIMPs. So for some reason, the funding for WIMPs is like 100 times greater than the funding for axions. And I don't quite understand that. But first thing is axions are much wimpier than WIMPs, and maybe that's why nobody wants to work on them. The axion scattering rate, I said, was highly suppressed by the 10 to the 12 GeV scale or something like that, whereas the WIMP scattering cross-sections are only suppressed by a 10 to the 3 GeV scale. Okay, so in this case, the axions are scattering on virtual photons from a magnetic field. It's magnetic energy that is the scattering target, whereas for the WIMPs, it's the density, the total target mass in nucleons or electrons that's the scattering target. But nonetheless, individual particle scattering is probably not detectable because it's just so weak. The other thing is axion masses I mentioned are pretty small. So if you take an axion mass of 10 micro EV, then the density of these guys would be 10 to the 16 per liter as opposed to WIMPs, which is just 1 per liter for 100 GeV masses. So the black jelly beans and the black coffee grounds are meant to represent the dark matter in each case. Okay, so it's much, much more numerous than WIMPs. Many more axions in this room than there would be WIMPs. Axions versus WIMPs 3. Axions are bosonic, and there's huge number density. So in fact, they can be described as a classical wave as defined by the number density and the line width. And if you go through that computation again, we're talking about 10 to the 26 quanta in bosonic quanta per mode. Okay, and this will turn out, this is how you beat the ultra weak coupling for axions, because you have a collective action of 10 to the 26 quanta, whereas WIMPs are typically fermions, or at least they're not in this highly coherent state. And so they scatter as individual particles, so you're directly suppressed by the electroweak scale. Okay, so then the correct way to think about the axion dark matter is that you have these huge occupation number bosonic modes that create locally coherent oscillations of the QCD theta angle. So remember, the vacuum had decayed to the minimum here, but then if you have this coherent wave of theta angle that has local energy density rho sub a, and remember the energy scale of this cosine potential was lambda QCD to the fourth, then how far you coherently and collectively move up this potential out of its minimum is going to be determined by the ratio of the local density to the lambda to the QCD scale. So it turns out that local dark matter will induce about 10 to the minus 19 radians of motion in the QCD theta angle. And so this partially undoes the Peche-Quinn mechanism. And so one obvious thing to do is instead of looking for a vanishing DC electric dipole moment of nucleons, you look for AC, oscillating electric dipole moments. So that's Casper Electric, that Peter Graham and others are working on. You can also look for oscillating signals in magnetic dipole forces from the axion-fermion coupling. Most of the traditional experiments are looking for the axion-photon coupling. So the axions, just like they couple to two gluons, they couple to two photons induced by a loop diagram. And one of the photon lines you terminate on the laboratory B field. And this then creates an oscillating current source. And you can use this current source to drive a cavity resonator. So that's the traditional Sakivi haloscope technique. And there's other experiments that do the same thing. These are cavity resonators. You can drive more general LC circuit resonators. And you can also just do Bragg focusing of the radiated power. So there's a number of different concepts that are currently being developed. I did mention that ADMX right now is the only experiment that's currently operating and actually probing deep into the axion, QCD axion parameter space. Okay, so here's another visualization for the grad students. So the axion modes are have a size given by the de Broglie wavelength, 1 over delta p. And for the masses we're currently looking at, these are football stadium-sized clumps, about 100 meters in each direction. They're slowly drifting through our detector, 300 kilometers per second, it's the local variable velocity. And so this gives phase coherence signals across multiple detectors, and in the coherence time, amount of time for these football stadiums to drift through your detectors is about a millisecond. Okay, good for the students. So these are like gigantic slow laser pulses. They're just moving at 10 to the minus 3 of the speed of light. Again, so we look for them through this coupling to two photons that's induced by a loop like this or by some other loop. Where the coupling, effective coupling constant in the effective field theory looks something like this. It'll be some model dependent, again, maybe order unity coupling factor G times fine structure constant and then suppressed by the Peche-Quinn scale. And usually the experiments are designed to reach what we think is a more pessimistic DFSZ axion coupling from model from these guys, where G is about 1/3. Okay, but obviously you can pick whatever value of G you want. But we like to think it might be order 1. Okay, so then this Keevy-Pierce haloscope technique points out, relies on the fact that you have this this coupling to two photons. You terminated one photon line on the external magnetic field. Okay, so now this becomes a bilinear coupling in which you have a theta angle oscillation of this amplitude, and it's a CP violating angle. So what it does is it converts magnetic field into electric field. You stick it into math. If you look at the Lagrangian and write it as the interaction term is J dot A, the current density just ends up being given by this expression. So it's interesting that because we're looking at this collective oscillation of the vacuum climbing out of its CP violating minimum, and the only scale in that potential was lambda QCD, you see that this formula for current density does not depend on the original phase transition scale anymore. Okay, so you're suppressed, your density suppressed by lambda QCD, but you're not suppressed by the Peche-Quinn scale.
You are indirectly suppressed because it depends on the mass. So the heavier it becomes, it decouples, right? Because there you have MA in your formula. So it enters indirectly, even though the amplitude is independent of the phase,
Well, something really interesting is going to happen. So I'll just kind of walk through this and I'll tell you what happens. So you have this current density that appears in Maxwell's equations, and it's just like any other current, except it's not carried by electrons or holes or positrons or protons or anything. It's carried by this interaction between the axion dark matter in contact with the laboratory magnetic field, B naught. So you just stick that on the right-hand side of Faraday's law and can drive Maxwell's equations just like any other current density can drive Maxwell's equations. And then you need a cavity because you're coming in with an axion whose energy is dominated by its rest mass and has almost vanishing momentum, and you're converting it into photons that are massless but have momentum. So you have to have some kind of spatial boundary condition to absorb that momentum. You'd like to resonantly absorb the momentum if possible. As long as you have something that can absorb the momentum, then you can actually convert axions into single standing wave photons in this region. Okay, so we use microwave cavities or any other kind of resonant antenna would also work. Okay, so once you have that condition, you have the momentum absorption, then the formula for the power that you deliver in the form of photons now contained within this resonator is just J dot E. Okay, so this is voltage times current, force times velocity, just whatever it is that you get from Maxwell's equations. Okay, so this is the power. Okay, and then the interesting thing is then if you convert power, so remember the photon frequency is equal to the mass, right? So if you convert power into photon rate, then you divide this by mass, that gets rid of this factor of mass. So now you have a signal strength that is independent of axion mass and independent of the Peche-Quinn scale. It only depends on
the ratio. Because in this case, you have regional convergence, so the cavity size matches the size of the axion.
Right,
true.
Right.
If you start making the gap smaller than the axiom,
yep.
then there's a gap.
Yep, yep. But that's an experimental detail. An experimental detail.
The, yeah, 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 it's true,
the
though.
Intrinsic the equations do not care about the axion mass, and they do not care about the Peshey-Quinn scale.
The number axioms, you don't care about the
axion.
The axion here.
Okay, good. Okay, so now back to where what Mina was talking about. In order to get this resonant power transfer, you need the size of your scattering target to be matched to the inverse momentum transfer. In the case of WIMPs, you're transferring like MeVs of momentum, capital MeVs. So you want 10 Fermi-sized atoms are naturally sized. That's why you get the enhancement for spin-independent interactions, where you get the sum, the amplitudes over all of the nucleons in a xenon atom, let's say, and then square after summing. In the case of axions, we're looking at like a 4 micro-EV mass. The scale is 50 centimeter size microwave cavities. Okay, and in order to match the resonance condition, so you want the cavity frequency to exactly match the axion mass, and this is where we get into trouble. I'll show a plot of that later. So as you go to higher and higher axion masses, you have to shrink the size of these cavities, and if you shrink the size of the cavities, then you're intercepting less of the dark matter beam. If you intercept less at higher frequencies, then you run into signal-to-noise issues. Okay. So another thing that is not always understood by everybody is that the transfer of energy from the axion dark matter to the RF cavity is the same as the transfer of energy between two pendula that are coupled by a weak spring. And this is also exactly the same formulas as neutrino oscillations. You start with some big amplitude in the axion wave, and through this coupling to the second pendulum that represents the photon mode in the cavity, you get this flavor oscillation in which the axions gradually decay and the photon wave gradually builds up, and then if the photon wave fully builds up, eventually it'll transfer energy back to the initial axion wave. Okay, so when the photon cavity frequency is tuned to the axion mass, that means you're on resonance. The mixing angle is 45 degrees, just like nu mu, nu tau mixing. And then in the limit of infinite coherence time, which unfortunately we don't have, all of the dark matter would be converted into photons. All right, but if you have a finite coherence time, which reflects reality, we only get a few signal photons per minute. This is another illustration that's interesting for the students. Okay. So that's the initial axion wave, and now the other one is the photon wave. And eventually, all of the amplitude will be transferred over. It took me 2 minutes at breakfast with my kids one morning to come up with this. Okay, so it's very weak coupling. It'll take many, many swings to fully transfer the wave amplitude. But we're never actually going to get there. The number of swings you get is the quality factor of either cavity or the axions. And the cavity has a very narrow response bandwidth. Okay, it's got a resonant frequency. Oh, look, that's the first oscillation maximum. So it does have a natural response frequency, and its lifetime determines the bandwidth of its response. Okay, so this is a very narrow band response. And so the experiments are going to be like searching for the J psi meson. You're scanning through one frequency bin, one mass bin at a time until you look for an excess. So if you know where to look, you can find it immediately, but if nobody travels back in time and whispers in your ear, it's gonna take a long time to find exactly where the resonance is. Okay, so here's just a picture. In reality, the achievable cavity quality factors are 10 to the 5. That means the cavity only gets 10 to the 5 swings before it damps out. And that's going to limit how long you get to build up the wave in your cavity. So you're going to be fully in the linear regime of this sine squared delta omega t buildup. So the accumulated energy in the cavity is going to scale as the lifetime of the cavity squared, which goes as the quality factor of the cavity divided by its frequency squared. And then the energy is dissipated, including leaking out into your readout, on the scale of the lifetime of the cavity. Okay, so just like the axion mass, there's only one scale in the problem, which is a lifetime. The instantaneous power extracted goes as T cavity squared divided by T cavity. So it only goes as one power of the quality factor of the cavity. And then you guys probably also know this story. The axion itself is kinetically broadened by the spread in virial velocities. So it's kind of interesting. So this is a cartoon of what the signal would look like. And if you can actually find the signal and resolve the shape of the velocity distribution, then there's all sorts of interesting things you can learn about the local distribution, phase-space distribution of dark matter. But we're typically looking at velocities that are 10 to the minus 3 of the speed of light. So the energy spread is 10 to the minus 6. Okay? And again, it's very narrow band. And again, you can reconfirm the signal in minutes once it's found. It's not like a WIMP search where you run for a year, and if you see something, you have to run for another 10 years. No, you find the signal, and you can see it again in minutes. So back to Mina's point. Here's the predicted signal rate for this more pessimistic coupling. So this is the photons per second as a function of frequency. So it's about 4 micro EV, 40 micro EV. So the predicted signal in a real world detector is going to shrink with the size of that cavity, because the volume of the cavity has to have linear dimension matched to the wavelength of the axion. So you're falling at least as fast as 1 over frequency cubed, and it gets worse because the materials that we use, we're using copper cavities, because we have to immerse these cavities in magnetic field. So copper exhibits what's called the anomalous skin effect, in which its conductivity also gets worse with frequency. So the quality factor of the cavities also gets worse. So anyway, it looks really bad. So we're kind of, and in blue, what I'm plotting here is the standard quantum limit noise. Okay, so the standard quantum limit, if I have time, I'll go into it a little more. But the point is that in any readout, you always have zero point noise in the readout from the Heisenberg back reaction. And in these units, it corresponds to plus or minus one photon of uncertainty per readout. And the amount of time it takes to read out is 1 over delta F, the detection bandwidth, which is given by the axion line width. Okay, so this is the axion line width, the mass of the axion divided by this 10 to the 6 quality factor of the axion. So the standard quantum limit noise scales linearly with frequency, whereas the signal is dropping as frequency to the minus 11/3. Okay, so the current experiments are kind of working over here in this region where the signal to background rates are of order unity. But as you go to higher and higher frequencies, you can see that these two lines are diverging at an alarming rate. And that's why we don't immediately go to higher frequencies. Even a factor of 10 in frequencies is already really, really bad. So just a quick advertisement for ADMXG2. This is a cavity that's being inserted into a magnet. Or I guess here it's being extracted. That's why all the ice is condensing onto the cold cavity. But the plan is we're probing from 500 megahertz to 10 gigahertz. Right now, we actually have probed deep into this band representing this order one uncertainty in the photon coupling. But over the next 3 to 6 years, we hope to get it all the way up to 10 gigahertz. So this is pretty much the world's most sensitive radio receiver looking for single microwave photons. We're using quantum limited squid amplifiers, and we're actually sensitive to signal powers as low as 10 to the minus 23 watts at each tuning. And it takes a few minutes at each tuning to determine whether we see the axion or not. Okay. Yes, we are using quantum limited amplifiers, which unless you're doing something really clever, is about as good as you can do, one photon of noise per readout. Again, ADMXG2 is kind of covering this region. There is another experiment called Haystack that's based at Yale University. This is their sensitivity. They haven't even gotten close to the DFSC signal yet. So now what we need to do to enable these experiments is, okay, the easiest thing to do is to improve the signal strength. So we need a bigger magnet. We need higher Q cavities. If we can come up with some materials that will survive in the magnetic field and still be low loss. We need larger volume cavities or systems of multiple cavities. And the other thing that I'm going to talk about today is we can squeeze the noise to go below the standard quantum limit.
Higher gate, does it help even when the dark matter coherence time is shorter? Because you lose by that, right?
Right. If you're doing a brute force search, you should not narrow band the cavity to smaller than the intrinsic line width.
It still improves the noise. No, you're right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I think in general, higher resolution is always better. You can always reap in afterwards.
Do you want to scan enough resonance?
Did you check
your signal of resonance? So
right, but you lose the Q enhancement when you're off resonance, the Q enhancement of the signal.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you didn't have the Q, how far off resonance could you go and still see the signal?
So right now you can view the cavity as a Lorentzian filter whose width is 10 times wider than the intrinsic signal line width.
Okay.
So for each scan we actually can see 10 signal bins each with a pretty good Q enhancement. And if you go further than that, then you don't get the Q enhancement in the signal. And the noise is always the same in any frequency bin, whether you're on resonance or off resonance.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Remind you us how do they scan? They change the physical parameters. So
they
some
stuff. Right, right. So there's a cylindrical cavity where the diameter of the cylinder kind of gives you the resonant frequency, and then you stick a piece of metal down the middle. And that breaks up, so it's the distance scale is now the radius rather than the diameter. And then if you move that, move the position of that rod around, then that creates different distance scales inside the cylinder, and that determines the resonant frequency. It also causes the mode to take a very strange shape. So again, this is kind of where we're at. If we want to look for the region that the CMB people are looking at, we want to get up here in this yellow region that's consistent with high-scale inflation. So how do we do that? So just then a little bit about quantum limited amplifiers in the last 15 minutes. Quantum limited amplifiers suffer from zero-point noise, just from the kick that you give to the system, the back reaction, whenever you make a measurement. Okay, so imagine you have a sine wave that you're trying to measure, and that sine wave, you can represent it in this phasor diagram with x observable, which you can think of as the potential energy-like observable when the pendulum swings all the way to its maximum and maximizes x. And then there's the kinetic energy-like observable, p, when that oscillator swings back down to its minimum and is traveling with its maximum momentum. Okay, so you can represent the state of the system with some amplitude alpha by this blue blob here, and then that system, as you evolve it in time, it'll move from potential energy to kinetic energy, back to potential energy, back to kinetic energy. So the system will rotate in this phase space diagram. And what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us is that this blob is symmetrically this blob has a minimum area of 1/2 h bar. Okay, that's what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says. It's the quantization of phase space area. So if you then try to read out this system using any kind of stupid readout, then what you're doing is let's say you stick it into an amplifier. You have this tiny little wave. After you come out of the amplifier, then you have this big wave. And with that big wave, you can simultaneously more precisely determine the amplitude of that big wave, as well as exactly where it is relative to some phase reference. So you're measuring simultaneously both amplitude and phase. That means you're simultaneously trying to take this error ellipse that's limited by Heisenberg and squeeze it in both directions, and it's going to fight you. Okay, so each measurement is going to give a kick to its conjugate observable, and you just can't do better than 1/2 h bar. And if you think of this if you think of this in the radial direction, the amplitude of the wave is the square root of photon number. This uncertainty in the radial direction translates to plus or minus one photon of noise, of back reaction noise per measurement. And this is what's currently killing us at high frequencies. Another thing that might provide insight is that normally you would have, at finite temperature, you would have kT of energy, so you wouldn't be quantum limited. You'd have this big, huge blob, kT of energy per resolved mode, kT over h bar omega of variance of spread. If you take temperature to zero, the quantum noise is one photon per resolved mode. All right, and this is what exceeds the signal rate. We have to do better. And so we've heard of squeezing from the LIGO experiments. So LIGO, looking for gravitational waves, they're trying to make phase measurements. So they're going to squeeze in the phase direction this way to get better phase resolution. In the case of axion searches, what we're trying to do is we're trying to detect a very small excess of photons. So we want to squeeze in the opposite direction. We want to squeeze in the radial direction. And the way we can do that is by doing single photon counting. So any kind of single photon detector, whether it's absorbing the photon or not, is going to give you amplitude information, but it's not going to give you any phase information. And so if you do that, you can squeeze in the amplitude direction while not doing and putting maximal back reaction back into the phase. The way that we want to do it is using quantum non-demolition measurements to implement a single microwave photon detector. Okay, so generally these quantum non-demolition measurements rely on the photon number operator, which a dagger a commutes with the Hamiltonian, which is what h bar omega a dagger a, puts a back reaction into the phase, allows you to measure if your technique is good enough. It allows you to measure exact photon number, and the noise will then just be the shot noise in the signal. Right. So that what that does is it takes this error circle, which was 1/2 h bar omega, and this is actually a coherent state in the language of quantum optics, and it squeezes it down into a Fox state, which would be this thin blue annulus in this representation, okay, where the photon number is precisely determined, but the phase is maximally uncertain. This was demonstrated by Hirosh and Wineland with Rydberg atoms, mainly by Hirosh, and they received this part of the reason they got the Nobel Prize in 2012. In the quantum computing community, this exact experiment, same thing, was demonstrated using solid-state artificial atoms instead of real Rydberg atoms, and this was done by one of my collaborators on this project. And more recently, in 2013 and 2016, this was proposed as a way of beating the quantum noise in higher frequency axion searches. So I'm just about out of time, but maybe I can quickly go through this. The way this works is in the case of real atoms, cavity QED, what you're doing is you're using the electric polarizability of a two-level atom to measure the electric field inside the cavity in a way that you're not actually absorbing photons at all. You're just using the electric field of the photons to change the frequency of the atom. So the photon modes are bosonic, so the number operator is a dagger a. The two-level atom, if you're constrained to a limited range in frequencies, only two of the energy levels of the atom are ever in play. So you can view this as a fermionic oscillator with a number operator sigma z, and raising and lowering operators sigma plus and sigma minus. So the first order nonlinearity in number operator squared in this flavor mixed Hamiltonian looks like this. Okay, so you have the bosonic harmonic oscillator, and then you have a fermionic harmonic oscillator at frequency omega a, but then there ends up being a nonlinear term that multiplies the bosonic number operator by the fermionic number operator. Okay, and what's in front is the energy g is the energy stored in the coupling between the two oscillators, and delta is the frequency offset between the two oscillators. So what this term means is that the total frequency of the atom is the sum of these three terms. It's bare frequency, there's a lamb shift, and then there's a term that's dependent on the occupation number of the cavity. So that means that the atom's frequency depends on the cavity's resonator's occupation number. And because these are just products of number operators, this whole thing commutes with the Hamiltonian. You never absorb any photons, and you can make this measurement over and over again. Okay, that's in fact what they did. This is a Ramsey interferometer, the precursor of modern-day neutrino oscillation experiments. You prepare the atoms in the state, you send them through the cavity, and then you have a FAR detector at the end that determines how much oscillation they went through. And then you start pumping the cavity full of photons to see whether you can see the phase shift. This would be the analog of neutrino matter effects, the neutrino beam passing through the Earth as a potential energy of interaction with the electrons in the Earth. Here, there's a potential energy of interaction between the atom beam and the photons in this cavity, and that will induce a phase shift. Okay, so here's the actual Nobel Prize winning data. Ground state at the analyzer. If there's a single photon in the cavity, then you have hundreds of atoms now that have undergone an extra phase shift, and by the time you read them out, they've oscillated into the excited state. Okay? Maybe I'll skip through. I have ways of demonstrating this just using classical physics. If anybody's interested, we can talk about it. But the point is that they're using real atoms where you have modes that are defined by the Coulomb potential. And the useful part is that the energy level spacings are non-degenerate, so you can locally, in frequency space, treat it as a two-level system. If you have any kind of oscillator, let's say cosine potential for a Josephson junction, you also have the same thing where the energy levels are non-degenerate. So anywhere where you have non-degenerate energy levels, you can use that as an artificial atom. And that's what we're doing. Here's an example of what's called a transmon qubit, where you have a couple of Josephson junctions forming a squid here. And this is the oscillator. And this is just a way that you create high capacitance in a two-dimensional circuit. So this is an example of a nonlinear anharmonic oscillator that can be used as a photon detector. Here it is in an actual system where it was demonstrated as a quantum non-demolition photon detector. So again, the qubit, the anharmonic oscillator is over here. You have two one-dimensional cavities. It's capacitively coupled here and here. There's standing waves that bounce back and forth here. And that models the axion dark matter wave. And it's coupled to this qubit. And if the qubit's artificial atom's frequency shift undergoes a quantized frequency shift due to occupation here, then it's also coupled to a secondary cavity. And so this guy's frequency shifts. And then you can probe this new frequency at the postulated frequency shift. You're asking it true or false. There's a photon in this cavity. Okay. If you're able to excite the qubit at its new frequency, then that's coupled to this cavity, and this cavity's frequency also shifts, and you can read out that frequency shift directly without perturbing the qubit and without perturbing the original system that might have axions in it. Okay, everything here, everything there is connected by mixing angles. You have a tangent squared 2 theta over here, another tangent squared 2 theta over here. So whatever you do here is very unlikely to pump false signals into your axion cavity. Okay, so in real life, we're probably not going to be using two-dimensional cavities. We want to replace these with full three-dimensional cavities and try to maximize the volume of those. But this was the initial experiment that was done.
This is a really limited size now. And the measure on frequency of your
right.
But this is so, what frequency is that?
These are typically done at 5 gigahertz, just for convenience.
Okay.
Yeah. And here's an example of just a shot noise spectrum. So you weakly pump the first cavity, so its average occupation number is 2, and then you do the readout procedure asking the qubit true or false, is there a photon in that cavity, true or false, is there 2 photons in the cavity, true or false, is there 3 photons in the cavity, and so as a function of the spectroscopy frequency of that qubit, you see a very nice Poisson distribution, indicating that you indeed have single photon resolution. So my graduate student and I are currently putting together an analog of this using three-dimensional cavities. This is a copper cavity is down here. So this is the end that you dunk into the magnetic field. The qubit is superconducting, so you don't want to dunk that into a magnetic field. So the qubit is going to sit up here safely away from there. And the two are going to be coupled by a cylindrical waveguide. Okay, so again, the qubit is just a Josephson junction, uses a nonlinear properties of Cooper pairs tunneling back and forth across that junction. And then in order to couple it to free space modes, this junction is way too small. It's only 253 nanometers. So then you put larger fins on the end until you reach the 200 micron scale, and you get something that you can actually see with the bare eye. And that creates a fairly large electric dipole moment, so that if you stick it into the cap of this cavity and stick it in here, then this electric dipole moment, given by this the size of this device, can then fairly efficiently see the electric field that's inside. Okay, so here's some predictions for where we're going to get. So again, these are the photon rates versus frequency. And the black lines are the predicted signal rates using various things. So we currently have a seven Tesla cavity. Yale has a 9 Tesla cavity. We're in the middle of procuring a magnet. We're in the middle of procuring a 14 Tesla magnet. But as you go up, increasing volume and field, the signal increases. This was the zero-point SQL background, standard quantum limit. And we believe that if we can get the error rate, the dark rate of these qubits, down to 0.1% per measurement. So remember, SQL was one photon per measurement, so this is 10 to the 3 improvement. And you give up a little bit because you're eating a lot of noise from the full cavity bandwidth. But nonetheless, you can reduce the noise level, the background rate, by a couple of orders of magnitude. And if you simultaneously increase the signal rate using the more traditional methods, then eventually you reach sensitivity to at least a KSVZ axion. And if you go to higher magnetic fields, or you can further improve the readout technology, squeezing the noise even more, reducing the backgrounds, then you can do even better than that. Okay, so I'm just about.
How much amount of squeeze did you get here?
This is where. The way to characterize this is the 0 point noise is one photon of uncertainty per measurement. Okay, so then the noise rate is that one photon times your how rapidly you're making the measurements. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you're making the measurements 10 times per second, that's 10 hertz of dark counts.
I see.
Okay, here we're saying if we can squeeze it down so that our error rate is 10 to the minus 3 instead of 1, then the overall noise rate is down by 3 orders of magnitude. And then there's some details why you don't get the full improvement. But nonetheless, by squeezing, you can really get down below the limit from the symmetric errors. Okay, so you still don't quite reach signal to noise equal to 1, but as long as the signal to noise ratio is not too bad, you can still do the experiment. Okay, so then the next thing is, how do you multiplex a bunch of cavities? So the WIMP experiments have Avogadro's number of scattering targets. How do we create something that is volume filling? A bunch of cells that are connected to each other, each one individually sized to be resonant at the frequency that we like, but then still sum up to have some large volume. And this is kind of what the quantum computing people do. The quantum computer needs qubits, cavities, it needs a quantum bus to move the information around, and it needs some plumbing, waveguides, and whatnot for readout. But this is all exactly what an axion detector needs. The instant you're talking about more than one cavity, more than one resonator, you need all of this plumbing. And the hope is that they're just going to solve this problem for us. But if we get impatient, we might try to solve the problem for them. So then there's a couple of other So in this case, the RAM is made up of these microwave cavities. And you move the information around from one place to another by sweeping the qubits across in frequency to move the excitation from one oscillator to the other using adiabatic level crossings. Okay, that's how you move the information around in a quantum computer. And similarly, you transport the information to your CPU.
So you just change we'll discuss it later.
Yeah, out of time.
Just
a couple of quick points that may or may not be of interest. Can you make an axion detector directly from qubits using the qubits as the oscillators rather than cavities? Because it's kind of annoying. You have 10 to the 26 axions, You're trying to move one quantum into the cavity and then use the qubit to detect whether there's one quantum in the cavity or not. Why not connect the 10 to the 26 axion quantum directly to the qubits? So one thing you can do is you can try to look for a frequency shift, where you don't actually transfer any quanta. Can you see the frequency shift just from the coupling to this other oscillator? It turns out you can't, because before I computed the photon rate, and that the photon rate has the units of frequency, and it turns out the frequency shift is exactly the photon rate. I think you can get this from the optical theorem. So again,
aren't your qubits superconducting or something, which doesn't play well with the
qubit? You can implement qubits using non-superconducting technologies as well, like quantum dots and whatnot. So this is all kind of at a very, very high level.
Right? It depends how big they are.
Yeah, right. So okay. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, eventually the size of the qubit is the right size.
We can discuss the photonic cavities, right?
Yeah.
Have you thought about photonic cavities at all, those that are micron?
I haven't, so maybe you should tell me about them afterwards.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, so this doesn't work because these are very low photon rates, and the corresponding frequency shift is numerically identical, quantitatively identical. We cannot see frequency shifts that small. We can try to directly excite the qubits, use the qubits as cavities. So then if the qubit actually absorbs a quantum, then its own readout frequency will shift. And there's actually these mysterious athermal qubit errors. So I told you before that the error rate for qubits is 10 to the minus 3 per measurement. And nobody understands why this is. The qubits are just sometimes found to be in the wrong state. And nobody understands why. They shouldn't be in the wrong state. There's no possibility that they're thermally excited to those states. So it could be that even the present-day qubits are somehow absorbing bosonic dark matter, and despite being very, very well shielded from electromagnetic radiation. Okay, I'm not making that claim, but it's a possibility. And then quantum computers, can they survive bosonic dark matter? So the current computers, like, everybody's doing, having, there's this blame game going on in industry where whenever a server crashes, they always automatically blame cosmic rays. Because the transistor size is shrinking so small that even a single cosmic ray coming through will flip a 0 to a 1 and cause your server to crash. So we'll see what happens with quantum computers. If quantum computers follow Moore's law, transistor count versus time, at some point the total volume of cavities will be quite interesting for the kind of bosonic dark matter we're looking at. But maybe there's more strongly coupled bosonic dark matter that's already affecting the individual qubits. And then just the takeaways. ADMX-G2 is operating 600 megahertz to 2 gigahertz. All experiments are quantum limited right now. And so the next step is squeezing. We want to do qubit-based squeezing. We can reduce readout noise by orders of magnitude. And then the final point, technical requirements for quantum computers are nearly identical for what we need for axion detection. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.